Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. Before we get started, I'd like to ask a favor. If you haven't done so already, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. If you've already done that, thank you. These ratings help the show get discovered so it can reach a wider audience. And while you're there, click the subscribe button so that you get notified of new episodes as soon as they come out. If you don't use Apple Podcasts, you can visit driveonpodcast.com/subscribe to find other ways of subscribing, including our email list. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everyone, today my guest is Valerie Pallotta. Valerie's son Josh served with my brother Stephen in the Vermont Army National Guard. Josh was deployed to Afghanistan in 2010, and upon returning home, he struggled with some physical injuries as well as post-traumatic stress. Valerie is here today to talk with us about some of the struggles her son went through and what she's doing now to help other veterans who are struggling the way Josh did. Valerie, I'm truly grateful that you're willing to share your story. Welcome to the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your son, Josh?
Thanks, Scott. I really appreciate being here and you giving me the time to talk about Josh. So as you said, I'm Josh's mom, and I don't know if you want me to talk a little bit about his background and growing up, but he was a pretty determined kid. Ever since he was little, he started to ride his bike, and he spent all day learning how to ride his bike, and he actually mastered it in one day. He was pretty determined. You know, in high school, he wanted to play lacrosse, and they didn't have a lacrosse team at the high school he was in, so he and I went to the athletic director and got the approval to start a lacrosse team. And they said, you know, you just need to come up with the names of kids to play, and here's how many kids you need. And he said, okay, I can do it. And he went and did it. And we went to the superintendent, and the superintendent approved it. And Colchester High School had a lacrosse team. And, you know, he was just pretty determined. And stubborn. He was a very stubborn person. but he really struggled. He struggled in high school a lot. He was pretty smart, very, very intelligent, but was very lazy. So that kind of affected him throughout his early adult life. He didn't really know. He barely graduated from high school. He was very unorganized, and once he graduated high school, he was trying to decide what he wanted to do with his life, and college was not really in the cards for him. Even though he had attempted, he just, you know, homework wasn't a thing that he wanted to do, so, you know, it just didn't happen. So we actually told him if he didn't find a job that he needed to move out, and we gave him kind of 3 months of a deadline of when he needed to move out, and he didn't find a job. And he ended up moving out and living with a friend. And then he ended up getting a job at TSA doing airport security. And actually there, that's where he met people who were in the Guard. And he met Theron Twitchell. And he decided that he wanted to join because he knew they were going to Afghanistan. So that's kind of in a nutshell how we got from there to here with his military service.
Sure, yeah. So let's kind of get to the point where right before he was deployed. So so when he was deployed, you and your family got involved with the parent network, with the unit that he was deployed with, which I'd imagine a lot of parents were involved with at the time. But then you found your way into, an organization called the Blue Star Mothers of America.
Yeah. What happened with that is Josh is our only child. So I kind of freaked out when he said he was going to join. You know, I knew he was going to Afghanistan, and of course I was very proud, and then very scared. So the Guard had a lot of resources, and one of them was the parent network, as you mentioned. And it was strictly parents in this group. There were no spouses, because parents have different issues than spouses do when their children are in the service. Mm-hmm. So it was a really good support network. And out of that, there were a group of us moms who really wanted to do something to give back and support our boys when they came home. And I did a lot of research to see what we could do. And that's where we found Blue Star Mothers of America. And then through that, we realized that Vermont did not have a chapter. So we chartered the first Blue Star Mothers of Vermont chapter. And I was the chartering president. And I was involved for quite a few years. So that's kind of how that came about. And we would do a lot of financial support for emergency support for veterans, supporting Gold Star families. And there were a couple of veteran transitional housing facilities here in Vermont in the area. And we would support them by providing meals and things like that once a month for veterans and Christmas and holiday gatherings. So that's the whole parent network, Blue Star Mothers. That's how that evolved.
Awesome. Yeah. And that's, I think, kind of an important thing to kind of note too for other parents who might be listening to this, who have, their children, their adult children who are, being deployed or, in the military involved with it, knowing that there are support groups for the parents out there too, because it's not an easy thing to see your child go off, as an adult to war and to,
right.
To have to go through all that. So,
well, one of the things about Blue Star Mothers though, is that we were so limited on our time and our availability that we had to narrow the purpose and the focus of Blue Star Mothers to just financial support and actually less of emotional support. So I know that they've been talking about offering another parent group for emotional support for parents. So I can look into that too. But right now that's really what their focus is now, is providing that emotional support, financial support for veterans.
Sure.
They also have a pet program.
Oh, okay.
So they have a pet program for veterans. Terry Sabins is a pet program coordinator, and she has paired up pets, mainly dogs, with veterans who are struggling.
Okay. Interesting.
It's been a pretty good program. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of support. I know you said you had to kind of tone it back a little bit and scale it down. But that's still a lot of support going into, that network there for the veterans and everyone who's kind of involved there. So that's still pretty awesome. So let's fast forward a little bit in time here. So we talked a little bit about your involvement with the group before the deployment and during the deployment. But let's fast forward to August of 2010. So at this point, Josh and the unit that he was with in the Vermont National Guard, he's in Afghanistan, and something pretty terrible happens. So my brother, Stephen, and Tristan Southworth were killed on the 22nd of August. And I know that day affected a lot of people. Obviously, it affected me and my family, but also the people who were there, the soldiers who were there that day, certainly affected them. How did that day, and it's probably not just one day, but it was probably a culmination of things that happened throughout the entire deployment. How did that deployment affect Josh?
Well, as you know from other soldiers who were there, it affected him in a really pretty bad way. He was pretty involved in when Stephen and Tristan were killed. And Josh had never known death before. He turned 21 in April of 2010. So he was fairly young. He had only known one person really who was sort of close to him, but not really. When he was in high school, he was a freshman and he played football, and there was a senior student who was playing football, and I guess he kind of took him under his wing and helped him out at the gym, and he ended up dying in a car accident. And Josh didn't really know him more than that piece of you know, the gym and things like that, but he cut out his obituary and he hung it on his wall and he left it there. So when Stephen and Tristan were killed, he never got over that. Never. I mean, you know, and he's gone now, and it was just something that he just could not get out of his memories, out of his dreams, his nightmares. And he sought help after. I mean, he was seeing a counselor, and he just, the guilt, I think, the survivor's guilt, was really bad with him. I mean, it affected me too, obviously. I mean, this was a very horrific time, as you know, and it just, you just don't get over that, you know?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, by saying it was a horrific time is, you know, certainly accurate. Were there stages that he went through, you know, kind of when he got back? Did you notice, you know, different stages? I know that a lot of times people talk about different stages of grief and things like that, that people might go through, but did he experience things kind of all at once, or was there some sort of process that he went through, some sort of stages that he went through?
Yeah, it was pretty much stages that he went through. He, you know, he was still living in his apartment when he got home, and he had a job still that he was going to for a little bit of time. And then a few months went on, and he, you know, he would have to get up at, he'd have to be at the airport for 5 a.m. And he was living with some roommates who partied till 5 a.m. Mm. So that was kind of not a very good situation for him. So he moved out of there and moved back home. And then he started not sleeping. So he wouldn't get up for work. And my husband changed his hours at work and started working from home so he could actually get Josh up in the morning to just get him up and help him, you know, just get in the shower and just get out of bed. And then we ended up asking him to move out again because he lost his job at TSA. He called out 54 times or something like that. They tried to help him. There are a lot of veterans who work there. The manager of, I don't know if he's a manager, what his position is, but Bruce McDonald is a veteran himself. And, you know, they tried to give him such a lot of support services and things like that. And he just wasn't getting through. So he lost his job and then moved out of the house, and he had a girlfriend at the time. He met her on leave when he was on leave in June, and he ended up moving into an apartment or in a house with shared house with my nephew and his wife. And then my nephew and his wife bought a house, so they moved out, and here Josh was with his girlfriend in this huge old historic house with no job. And he actually wanted to borrow money from us and asked me, and I told him no, thinking that tough love would help. And I went for 9 months. My son wouldn't talk to me. I thought tough love would be the thing and would help him. And I said, you know, Blue Star Mothers is out there. There are a lot of other agencies. You can, you know, apply for assistance, and it was a very volatile time with he and I, and we never recovered that before he ended his life. So he ended up getting another job. He was still talking to my husband. He got another job. He moved, broke up with his girlfriend. He moved to Burlington. He got an apartment in Burlington, and he found a job making sandwiches. And he absolutely loved the job. It was, he could walk to work. He told my husband, he said, "Dad, I'm making sandwiches and I love it." He, you know, it's like, I'm washing floors, I'm making sandwiches. And he was just so proud. And then he could walk to work. He had a great relationship with the other people in the apartments in his apartment building. And then the place that he was working at closed. So when you talk about stages, I mean, it's, he was not doing well. He got better. He, something happened to make things, you know, he told my husband, he said, every time I take a step forward, something happens and I take three steps back. So it was a culmination of losing his job. The girlfriend thing, I think, was a good thing, but it was a number of things that just piled up.
It gives him that feeling of like what you might expect being in quicksand. It's like you feel like you're making progress, but then you slowly slip back, and almost feels like you no matter how hard you're struggling, no matter how much you're doing, you're not ever really making progress, even though you are doing the things that you're supposed to be doing, you know, that to make those steps. But then you don't quite feel like you're getting there. So let's maybe fast forward a little bit to September of 2014. So at that time, so he's been struggling for a few years with you know, various things, you know, like you talked about losing the job, and you know, figuring out, you know, places to live and the money situation and all that kind of stuff. In September of 2014, so Josh loses his battle with post-traumatic stress, and as a parent myself, I can't imagine how tremendously difficult something like that must be, you know, as a parent, to see your child struggle, you know, trying to help them out in every way that you can, you know, pointing them in the right direction, and then, you know, seeing kind of that culmination and what happens there. Anyone could completely shut down after going through something like that, you know, as a parent. But that's not really what you did ultimately. You went on, and you've been working, what seems to me anyways, tirelessly, trying to help other veterans to not end up in that same situation. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about what you're doing now, and you know, the fund that you've created, and all the other things that you've kind of been involved with, you know, to help veterans. So, you know, maybe we could start with the fund and what that's all about. And
sure. So, just to step back just a little bit, when he found out about his job closing, they had a work party on Sunday. And on Tuesday morning at 2:50 a.m. is when he killed himself. So it was just 3 days after, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 3 days after he found out that the place was closing. So it was the struggles and the stages went on for, you know, the 4 years. And it was like that last straw was losing that job.
Right. It seems like, you know, that one event in and of itself may not have been so disastrous, but it was all those things kind of adding up. It was kind of like that last straw that broke the camel's back, type of thing. Wow.
So Because of my work with Blue Star Mothers, I was pretty well known in the community. And people, after Josh died, they just started donating money to Blue Star Mothers. And they just, people wanted to do something, you know, it touched everybody. And they just wanted to give back. So they started donating money, and our Blue Star Mothers put the money in a separate account and kept it separate. And then it got to the point where there was a lot of money and it was too much to still be held in Blue Star Mothers. So my husband and I said, you know, we need to do something. And, you know, I had done a lot of research on PTSD and veteran suicide even before Josh joined the Guard, because I have a background in aromatherapy and I really wanted to support service members and veterans with post-traumatic stress back then. So we just wanted to do something. And I had always had this vision of complementary therapies, complementary healing modalities for post-traumatic stress. So we had that piece, and then we just started talking to veterans and asking them what would have helped Josh and what would help them. And the ones we talked to said, we just want a place to hang out and be together and play video games. And that was it. Mm-hmm. They just, especially with veterans in the Guard, because they don't have a military base. They're, you know, 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks out of the summer, and that's it. And they've gone from, as you know, they've gone from this year-long 24/7 together deployment to go back to nothing. Mm-hmm. And that was one of Josh's biggest problems, was he lost that brotherhood. He didn't have that connection. He, because of his physical injuries, he had gained so much weight that he couldn't work out. He was 300 pounds when he died. 289, 290, something like that. I think it was 300. So we decided that what we wanted to do was hold on to the money and just start raising money and find this space that veterans could come to get the wellness piece with aromatherapy, chiropractic, massage, yoga, all of the things that are coming out now as showing beneficial for post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And the things that doctors aren't, you know, your insurance isn't covering it, TRICARE doesn't cover it. The VA, I have to say, the VA is coming out with some of these programs and they are doing things like this now. But there are a lot of veterans who don't want to go to the VA. So we want to offer an alternative for them if they don't choose to go to the VA.
Sure.
And then there's the recreational side of it. So let's have a game room and a video room and a pool table and a gym and things like that where they can just come and de-stress. And then we took and be together. And then we took it a little further and said, you know, there are veterans who are going back to school. They've got little kids running around. They don't really have a place that's quiet to study. So why don't we set up some study rooms in this place? So we decided that we just wanted to put together a wellness rec center and then have a community kitchen for them to have meals. It's frustrating because, as you know, the statistics are 20 to 22 suicides a day, veteran suicides a day. And that's, I believe, just documented. I think it's higher than that. I think the fact that people are still out there raising awareness of veteran suicide is kind of archaic. I think we have to start doing something about it. People know about veteran suicide. So let's start asking what they want. I mean, they might not even know. And I think the problem is that veterans aren't talking about it, especially with active duty soldiers, because of there's still a stigma of being demoted and being ridiculed if you talk about having a problem. And mm-hmm. I just don't understand. I don't know. It's just very frustrating to me that that's still an issue.
You know, and there's probably still a little bit of the kind of an old school mentality of mm-hmm. just suck it up, be a man, deal with it kind of thing. And the support that you would hope is there is not quite where it should be. Now, I'm sure it's getting better in that regard, you know, where people are more, the awareness piece that you're talking about, people are more aware that there are problems that people are going through, and no one wants to see, you know, another soldier, another Marine, airman, you know, sailor, anything like that. No one wants to see any of them hurt themselves or do things that are, you know, not going to help them. But sometimes people just don't know what to do, you know, and having a space like this, that you guys have created, I think is, really a step in the right direction. I think more things like this should be done. You know, obviously you're, you know, in the Vermont area, and so that's that's great for the Vermont soldiers, but there's soldiers all over the country that are looking for things like this. And I actually spoke on the podcast a few weeks ago to someone who was from the VFW, and one of the things that the VFW offers is that camaraderie, the you know, being able to get together with those like-minded people. And, you know, maybe it's not necessarily, you know, playing video games or whatever, although I don't know, maybe they have that as well. But there are organizations out there that allow veterans to come together with other veterans and have that
stigma. There's a stigma with that because a lot of the younger veterans think that those VFWs are old, curmudgeon-y veterans who just sit around and want to compare wars. And my husband and I are members of the VFW here, the local VFW and the Legion here in Vermont. And there are a few younger veterans from Josh's unit who come, and that's it. They love to go. They go every Friday night.
Right.
And I think that stigma's there, though, and that's what the VFWs want to do. They want to provide that space, but that's another thing that needs to change is that mentality that it's just a place for the old, you know, Vietnam vets who just sit there and get drunk and, you know, 10 in the morning. Yes, there are some of those, but they do a lot of good here anyway.
Right. Yeah, and that's what we talked about, and I'll link to that episode in the show notes too for anyone who's listening who wants to listen to that episode and kind of hear what the VFW is all about, what they're doing, what their mission is, and they do other things too, not just provide a kind of community space. They advocate on behalf of veterans for different legislation and things like that, and it's really a great organization to kind of dip your toe in the waters of getting back into that kind of community. You know, if you want, it's not the, you know, the drinking club of, you know, our grandparents' era or whatever. Although, like you said, there's a little bit of that still goes on, but there are the younger generations, that are participating in the VFW as well. And the other, veteran service organizations that are out there, they accept everybody, you know, so
they're great.
You know, age is not an issue necessarily with that.
Right.
So you started the fund, you know, the Josh Pallotta Fund, and you created this safe space for these veterans to kind of come to with other veterans and things like that.
Well, we created the vision for the space. We don't have the space yet. We're working.
You don't have
on
the
that.
Space yet. Okay. Okay.
That's a muddy issue. We're in negotiations right now with an owner of a building that is actually in the old VA space in Colchester, Vermont, in the fort, and we had looked many times at purchasing a place or building a new place, and it was about $1 million. So a couple of things. We're looking at this space. We're in negotiations to lease it. Upstairs is already a tenant in there who is, I always screw up the name, but it's the Vermont Center for Responder Wellness. Or Vermont Responder Wellness Center. I get it mixed up. But he's Sonny Privetto. He is doing exactly what we want to do, but he does it for first responders and police officers. And he's a former police officer. So he's got a yoga studio up there. He does EMDR. He does biofeedback. And he provides these services free to police and first responders. And now he's starting to offer it to veterans. So it's kind of like we're in this stage. But I also want to start figuring out some sort of a mentoring program for veterans so that they can help other veterans. I also want to look at some sort of a income generating business that can help sustain the center. I don't want to charge veterans or maybe we'll charge a small membership fee or something like that. But so that it's not ready yet, but I'm hoping that we're going to open it up in the beginning of the year. Mid-year probably. Sure. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to it. So we don't have the space yet, but we're getting there, Scott.
So anyone who's listening to this, I'm going to have a link to the fund's website, and on the website, there is a place that you can send donations to and send all your donations to the fund to help get this kickstarted and move it in the right direction. You've also, shortly after Josh died, you also went down to Washington to testify before the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that? What it was that you were testifying on, and what the legislation was that was kind of involved with that?
Yeah. So I didn't know at the time what the legislation was for that I was going to be testifying for. And it was actually the Clay Hunt Act. And I'm going to screw this up because I still don't know a lot about it, but it was Clay Hunt was a veteran who was an advocate who started, I think he started a retreat program for veterans who were struggling with post-traumatic stress. And he ended up ending his life also. And it has to do, and I'm going to screw this up, so I probably shouldn't even start talking about it, but I'm going to screw it up. When I got the call from Bernie Sanders' office, because I was in the news here, the local news, about Josh's suicide, and this Clay Hunt's mom, Susan Selke, was starting this bill for veterans, and Bernie's office called me and asked me if I could go testify. And of course, it was 8 weeks out of Josh's death. So,
oh wow!
And I had never flown alone before, which I know it sounds crazy, but I don't fly much. I don't ever go anywhere, and I flew alone. And it was interesting because General Cray, the former adjutant general of the Vermont National Guard, was my seatmate, and he was going down to DC for something else.
Oh, wow.
So after playing around with my seat the night before and messing around with it, and then having General Cray sitting right next to me, I think that my boy was probably had his hand in that, because I bent his ear from Burlington to DC. So it was actually a good thing. And I think one of the things that I found out from that conversation was, and I'm off track, but when I had talked about one of the things that I think is needed is that there needs to be more deprogramming when veterans come back from deployment. And what I was told was, we don't have time. We are already training for the next mission. And I think that's wrong.
Right.
That needs to be changed at a legislative level. And that is one of the next things I'll do once we get Josh's house built, is to advocate to have a change on a legislative level of, these men and women need time to decompress and deprogram. And it's not happening. It's constant mission focused.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, when Josh and their unit came back, Josh told me flat out, "Mom, they asked me if I thought I had PTSD. Do you think I'm going to admit that I have PTSD? Of course I do. I don't want to go to Fort Drum. I want to go home." They're not going to, you know, I mean, that's just
right.
The stupid way to do it. And then they did the Yellow Ribbon events, which are great. You've got guys who have been together for a year and then don't see each other for 3 months. And then they put them together in a room and give them PowerPoint presentations. It's not done. Granted, that's great information, but that needs to change. They don't want that after 3 months of being apart. They're all out drinking.
Right.
Yeah. They're together.
I know from my own experience, and obviously my experience is a little bit different than the other people who I deployed with, because I came home a little bit earlier after my brother was killed. But going to like the Yellow Ribbon program, you know, and sitting through those PowerPoint presentations, I'm thinking to myself, like, we have a group of guys here who just spent like a year away from their families, mm-hmm. and now we're going to steal their weekend basically, mm-hmm. and sit them in front of a, you know, presentation on TRICARE. All this other stuff that they don't, yeah, TRICARE and all these other things that they don't, it's going in one ear and out the other, exactly. Essentially. They're thinking they want to go spend time with their family or go, you know, hang out with their friends or whatever it is that they want to do. The people that they haven't seen, you know, very much in the last year, I think right. they'd probably rather go and do that.
Yes.
And so it, unfortunately, it's very well intentioned. I just don't think it's very well executed.
Agreed.
And, you know, definitely could use some work in that regards, you know, to have a better execution on that. I don't have the answer for that.
I do.
But, oh, do you? Okay.
I do. I don't have to tell you now, but so my answer to that is that you let them come home. They get 3 weeks off, a month off, whatever it may be. And then they go back to their units and they do a 7-to-3 job. They're, especially with the guard, because they aren't, unless they're on orders, they're back to their civilian jobs. They're on, you know, vacation for three months or whatever. I think what needs to happen is they need to be reintegrated back into that military lifestyle. But you treat it as active duty orders, and it's a job from 7-to-3, 8-to-4. And then you go and you do PT, you have some counseling if you need it, but then you go home to your families at night.
Right.
And you do all these things to decompress. You do the EMDR, you do the biofeedback, you do the counseling, you do the PT, you do yoga, you do all of these things, but you teach these things before deployment too. You teach them these resiliency tools. And I'm talking resiliency in terms of mindfulness, meditation, yoga, things that will help them to be in a state where they can get away from their nightmares. And I'm not saying that in a way that's making any sense, but if you know what I mean. I mean, I think they need to start teaching those tools before deployment, and then you have the deployment, and then you come back and you're doing all of these decompressing tools. You're still having time with your family. You're still with your brothers. And I don't know, that's just in my opinion and from the research I've done, what I think might be helpful. I mean, why not try it? I mean, what can it hurt? You
know? Right. Yeah, and looking at the statistics, I just saw a report earlier today that in the 10-year there's a 10-year time period where on average about 6,000 military veterans killed themselves each mm-hmm. year.
Yeah,
and when a day. Yeah, and when you look at the total number of combat losses, mm-hmm. it doesn't even equal 1 year. You know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, it doesn't even equal 1 year's worth of the people that we lose at home.
Right.
And so we're losing like so many more people at home than we are in combat. And it, to me, it just doesn't make sense. Whatever we're doing, it's like the saying, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, we've been doing the same thing over and over, and we're not getting a different result. And unfortunately, something needs to change. And things like, like what you're working on and other organizations are working on, I think are a step in the right direction to help with all of that stuff.
But the sad thing is that my organization, Lucky De Palma's organization with the horse therapy, Lucky mm-hmm. was, you know this, but Lucky was in Josh's and Steven's unit. There are these organizations that are trying to do these things, but we have no government funding.
Mm-hmm.
We are the Josh Pallotta Fund, and I'm sure Lucky's too, the Veteran Barn Door Project. They rely on donations and fundraisers, and that's the only thing that we've been working on this for 3 years, I think. Josh died in 2014. The fund, has been around, but we didn't really come up with the idea for the first year after Josh died was just a total blur. So it's frustrating because there is money out there, but it's taking a long time to raise funds. And it's hard because these programs are showing to be beneficial. They work.
Right.
And that's the hard part. We know they work. So
that's where the money should be going to, with these organizations instead of, whatever the bureaucracy and, the government agencies, wherever they're funneling the money is, it hasn't been working. So let's put it to, someplace where it actually is going to work, and give these other, forms of therapy and other, things that might be beneficial to try. And you seem like you have a lot of good ideas on the subject. You are definitely making strides in the right direction. One last question for you, on this. So let's just say someone has a loved one who is struggling with post-traumatic stress. They're, similar situation to, your son. What would be something that you might tell that person that they can do for their loved one who's struggling? Either an organization that they could take them to, or something that they can do, because a lot of times people might experience that their loved one is going through something, some sort of issues, but they just don't, they feel helpless. They don't know what to do, with that. Well, in your opinion, through your experience and talking to other people and seeing what's out there, what would you offer as advice to those people?
So I think I'm a horrible person to offer advice, honestly, because my boy didn't talk to me for 9 months before he killed himself. And that's a guilt that I will live with for the rest of my life. I think it's hard when you're a loved one, because I feel like you want to protect those that you love. I think it's hard for a loved one to say, I recognize that you're struggling. Have you thought about going to this agency or this agency? Our loved ones who are struggling hide it from those who are closest to them. Mm-hmm. They want to protect them. They don't want to hurt them. I think what I think might help is if their loved one reached out to their friends and said, hey, Scott's struggling. Can you check in on him?
Mm-hmm.
Here are some things that I've seen that help. I think the other thing is that when you're in that state of stress and worry and anxiety, it's really hard for them to not look at everything in one big picture. You know, their Josh was like so overwhelmed by everything that he couldn't just focus on one little thing. And I think if you can help them to break things down and figure out what is the biggest thing that's bothering them, if it's sleep or nightmares or a job or whatever, first of all, getting them out to exercise is huge. I mean, if you can take them on a river rafting trip or a hunting trip or you know, skiing or something in nature, I think is huge. Something physical is huge. But it's going to take work. Get them involved, help them find a purpose. I think, when they lose their purpose, they lose their ambition and their motivation. So I think finding a sense of purpose is huge, along with getting them moving their body. I think that's when, you know, if they're, and I don't know how you can get them off the couch playing video games to going for a run or whatever, but I think friends are better able to get them moving, get them involved in a mentoring program with kids, you know, youth that are struggling. That will give them a purpose. That will make them get out of bed, and it will feel like they're serving a purpose and helping somebody.
Right. I love that. So I'm going to just kind of rewind a little bit here and go back to something that you said, that you're not the best person to kind of talk about this. And respectfully, I'm going to disagree with that and say that I think that you're the perfect person to talk about this, because you've gone through it, you've experienced these things, and you have, you know, just through kind of learning about what you've done, you have a passion about this, you know, to make sure that other families don't go through something like this, something like your family went through. And so I would say that you're probably a perfect person to kind of come up with, you know, some sort of advice like this. And I think the advice that you gave is spot on. One of the common things that I've heard through talking to other veterans, are all things that you've talked about. So they want a way to come together with their other military friends, you know, in a group setting. It doesn't necessarily have to be the people that they deployed with or that were in their unit or anything like that, but other like-minded military people. Exercise is a huge thing for people. And I think maybe even the biggest thing is that sense of purpose. Serving something that's bigger than themselves, because really when you're in the military, that's what you're doing. You're serving your country. Right. You're out there fighting for people that you don't know. You're fighting to defend, you know, a country of people who may or may not even be grateful that you're over there fighting.
Right.
But you're still doing it anyways, because it's a purpose that's bigger than yourself. And, you know, so whether it's through a, you know, a church group or, a school or, you know, some other organization, you know, like a, you know, Boy Scouts or, you know, Girl Scouts or, you know, whatever, those types of things, something that is going to help other people kind of can help you keep moving on. And that's a reoccurring theme that I've seen over and over and over again, talking to other people who have struggled with things and have come out on the other side better by hitting rock bottom and discovering some of this stuff on their own. And everything that you talked about is, does resonate with other people. These are things that people definitely have used, and tactics that they help them, you know, kind of move on and get through the issues that they were struggling with. So before we wrap up, where can people go to find out more about the fund everything else that you're involved in?
So it's, I just have to give you a little warning. Our website needs serious updating, but it's, you can go to our website. It's joshpallottafund.org. It's P-A-L-L-O-T-T-A.org. We have a Facebook page. We have a page, Josh Pallotta Fund Facebook page. And then we have a page that's in memory of Joshua R. Pallotta, which is, a lot of just, you know, his friends and just a lot of things about him specifically. And then the Josh Pallotta Fund Facebook page is more about our events and fundraising, and things like that. And I share a lot of articles that have come out with, research and things like that. So that can be pretty helpful too. We do have, I have my own Instagram page, but I do post some of our, events on there, and I have a Twitter account. It's just Valerie Plata, for both of them, but, okay. Specifically the website and the Facebook page.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. And so I'll have links to all of those, things in the show notes. So if anyone who's listening, you know, click on the show notes for this episode and you can find links to all of that stuff. So you can find out how you can help the Josh Pallotta Fund and get the wheels moving, you know, to help build the house, or, you know, get that space, opened up for the vets who need it. And, thank you for being on the show and sharing your story and everything that you're up to.
And I do want to say that, this one house is not the one and only Wellness Rec Center for veterans. I plan to create more throughout the state of Vermont and then expand out, because there's nothing like it anyplace else. And I think this is needed. So you are right. I do have a passion and I'm on a mission, and this mom is not going to give up.
I would not think, from talking to you, I would not think that you will. So, so thank you for the passion that you have, to help out, you know, veterans who are in need, and thank you for being on the show and sharing your story.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it. Thanks. And thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com, or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.